You're listening to ADIS on Radio Hanger. I'm Tower. So here's a question for you. What do you get when you spend $1 billion taxpayer dollars on an airplane and then decide you don't want it anymore? You get one of the most fascinating what-ifs in aviation history, and that's exactly where we're going today. Today's segment is brought to you by AviationSoul.com. Aviation Challenge coins built to mark the milestones, discipline, and pride behind every step in flight. From first solo to airline transport pilot, every coin tells a story. AviationSoul.com. All right, let's rewind to the early 1960s. The Cold War is in full swing, the space race is heating up, and in aviation, the next frontier isn't just going higher, it's going faster. A lot faster. The British and French are already deep into their Concorde program, the Soviets are working on the Tupolev 144, and the United States, the country that invented powered flight, the country that broke the sound barrier, is sitting on the sidelines of the supersonic transport race. President Kennedy wasn't having it. In 1963, JFK stood before Congress and called for a national supersonic transport program. The goal was bold and characteristically American. Don't just match Concorde, beat it. Build something bigger, faster, and more commercially viable than anything the Europeans or the Soviets could dream up. And so the Federal Aviation Administration, or FAA, launched a design competition. Three major manufacturers threw their hats in the ring. Lockheed proposed a delta wing design. North American Aviation had their own concept. And then there was Boeing. Boeing's entry was called the 2707, and it was audacious. Here's what you need to know about this airplane. While Concorde was designed to cruise at about Mach 2, roughly 1,300 miles per hour, the Boeing 2707 was targeting Mach 2.7. That's nearly 1,800 miles per hour, almost three times the speed of sound. And it wasn't just faster, it was bigger. Concorde carried about 100 passengers in that narrow, elegant fuselage. The 2707 was designed for 250 to 300 passengers. This was going to be a real airliner, not a boutique experience for wealthy transatlantic travelers. Boeing wanted supersonic flight for the masses, or at least that was the pitch. In 1966, Boeing won the government contract, and this is where the engineering gets really interesting. The original design featured something called a variable geometry wing, swing wings if you prefer. The wings would extend outward for takeoff and landing, giving the airplane the low-speed lift characteristics it needed. Then at altitude, the wings would sweep back tight against the fuselage, slicing through the air at nearly Mach 3. It was the same concept being used on military aircraft, like the F-111, but nobody had ever tried it on something this large, and that was the problem. The swing wing mechanism on an airplane this size was an engineering nightmare. The pivot hardware alone added enormous weight, and weight is the enemy of everything in aviation, but especially in supersonic flight, where every extra pound means more fuel burned, less range, fewer passengers, thinner margins. The engineers kept running the numbers, and the numbers kept coming back ugly. By 1968, Boeing made a gut-wrenching decision. They scrapped the swing wing design entirely and switched to a conventional delta wing. Similar in concept to Concorde, but scaled up dramatically. A fixed double delta configuration. Now that sounds like a step backward, but it was actually a pragmatic move. It shed thousands of pounds of mechanical complexity. The airplane became more buildable, and Boeing was already behind schedule. The redesign meant they were essentially starting over on major structural elements. Costs ballooned, timelines slipped, and remember, this was a government-funded program. Every delay, every cost overrun was being paid for by the American taxpayer. By the late 60s, roughly $1 billion had been invested. In today's money, that's somewhere north of $8 billion, a staggering sum. And there was no flying prototype, not even close. They were still working through the fundamental engineering challenges, but the technical difficulties weren't what killed the 2707. The headline doesn't tell the whole story on this one. What killed it was a collision of politics, economics, and something relatively new in American public life. The environmental movement. By 1970, the national mood had shifted. The optimism of the Kennedy era had given way to Vietnam, economic anxiety, and a growing awareness of environmental consequences. The first Earth Day was held in April of 1970. The Environmental Protection Agency was established that same year. And the supersonic transport became a lightning rod. Critics raised three major objections. First, the sonic boom. A Mach 2.7 airliner flying overland routes would produce a thunderous boom that would rattle windows, disturb livestock, and make life miserable for everyone underneath the flight path. Tests conducted with military aircraft flying supersonic over Oklahoma City in 1964 had already demonstrated this. The public hated it. People filed complaints. Some reported cracked plaster and broken windows. Second, there were concerns about the upper atmosphere. scientists were beginning to understand that high-altitude supersonic flight could damage the ozone layer. The 2707 would be cruising at around 60 to 70,000 feet, right in the heart of the stratosphere. The science was preliminary, but the worry was real. And third, the economics just weren't adding up. The airline industry was already struggling with the costs of transitioning to wide-body jets. The Boeing 747 had just entered service in 1970. Airlines were hemorrhaging money trying to fill those enormous airplanes. The idea of adding a supersonic fleet on top of that financial burden was, to put it gently, a tough sell. So on March 24, 1971, the United States Senate voted 51 to 46 to cut funding for the supersonic transport program. The House followed suit shortly after, and just like that, it was over. Boeing had to lay off thousands of workers in Seattle. The economic impact was so severe that someone put up a billboard near the airport that read, quote, "Will the last person leaving Seattle turn out the lights?" End quote. The city was devastated. Now, here's where it gets interesting from a historical perspective. Was Congress right? If you look at what happened to Concorde, the argument gets complicated. Concorde did fly. It was a technological marvel. It entered service in 1976 and operated for 27 years, but it was never commercially successful. Only 20 were ever built. It only flew two routes profitably, London to New York and Paris to New York. The sonic boom problem meant it could never fly supersonic over land, which gutted its route potential. And after the tragic crash of Air France Flight 4590 in 2000 and rising maintenance costs, both Air France and British Airways retired their fleets in 2003. So the environmental concerns were legitimate. The economic concerns proved prophetic. And the sonic boom problem was never solved. Not for Concorde. Not for anyone. At least not yet. But here's the counterargument, and it's a fair one. The United States gave up on pushing the boundary. The Concorde program, even as a commercial disappointment, advanced aerospace engineering in ways that are still paying dividends. Material science, high-temperature metallurgy, fly-by-wire systems, advanced aerodynamics. The British and French engineers who worked on Concorde went on to shape decades of aerospace innovation. What did we lose by walking away? Some historians argue we lost a generation of supersonic expertise, that the institutional knowledge, the engineering momentum, simply evaporated when the program was canceled. And when companies like Boom Supersonic came along decades later trying to build new supersonic transports, they were in some ways starting from scratch. This affects you if you're paying attention to the current supersonic revival. Boom Supersonic is developing the Overture, designed for Mach 1.7 with a target of 65 to 80 passengers. NASA is flying the X-59, a quiet supersonic technology demonstrator designed specifically to address that sonic boom problem that helped kill the 2707 55 years ago. The FAA is also actively working on new regulations for supersonic flight over land. For decades, supersonic overland flight has been effectively banned in the United States. If the X-59 demonstrates that a shaped sonic boom can be reduced to a quiet thump, the regulatory landscape could change dramatically. So the 2707 never flew. $1 billion, thousands of jobs, and one of the most ambitious aerospace programs in American history. All of it ended by a Senate vote. But the questions it raised, about speed versus efficiency, about environmental responsibility, about the proper role of government in aerospace development, those questions are still very much alive. Every time you read about Boom or NASA's quiet supersonic research or new FAA rulemaking on supersonic flight, you're reading the next chapter of a story that started with Boeing's swing wing dream in 1963. Whether Congress made the right call depends on what you value. They saved the taxpayers from what almost certainly would have been a commercial failure. But they also closed a door that took half a century to reopen. Sources today from Simple Flying and the historical record on the Boeing SST program. More at RadioHanger.com. I'm Tower. See you next time on ADIS.